looking for again?
Dope, money, and guns.
David Ayer is not a filmmaker averse to taking risks, having twice given us an intense hyper-real twist on the cop genre, writing Training Day and writing and directing End of Watch. He then won widespread critical acclaim for Fury, his visceral take on the war film.
If you think it can't get worse, it can, and it will. The dying's not done, the killing's not done.
We're still in this fight! We're still in this fight!
Now he brings us Suicide Squad, a big budget adaptation of the cult DC comic which he both wrote and directed.
I want to assemble a task force of the most dangerous people on the planet who I think can do some good.
They're bad guys.
Exactly.
While it's fair to say the film has not been well received by the critics, the fans seem undeterred, flocking in record numbers to watch it. Not that either of these things really matter to us, for here it is all about the music. I'm Edith Bowman, and you're listening to the second episode of Soundtracking, a weekly podcast in which I speak to the cinematic A-list about the relationship between sound and vision. And there are plenty of sonic delights to enjoy in David's work, from Suicide Squad's blistering soundtrack to the scoring of composers Stephen Price and David Sardi in Fury and End of Watch. During the course of our conversation, you'll hear tunes from artists as diverse as Black Sabbath, Grimes, Rick James, Eminem, and Creedence Clearwater Revival. But we begin, as Suicide Squad does, with one of the most famous guitar riffs of all time. Music is an intrinsic part of this new film. Are you at a stage now where you can kind of get anything cleared? You can pick any piece of music you want, pretty much?
In the case of this movie, yes.
There is a house in New Orleans. They call the rising sun.
We spent a vast amount of money on music on these source songs to get them in the film.
Nice position to be in.
It was fun. I mean, it's really being able to stab your finger in the catalog and kind of know that almost anything could come in. Clearance is interesting because sometimes they're held by the artist, the right, sometimes they're held by the estate of the artist, and different estates will have different conditions on how you can use a song. So you're not just dropping a quarter in a jukebox, you kind of have to work it out.
I love the way the first 15 minutes of the film, you're introduced to all these characters through them all having their theme tunes, so to speak. Was that an idea early on that you had, or was it something that developed as the project went on?
It was something we developed as the project went along. I love using, you know, source cues, just regular songs, almost a score, and I've done it in every movie. She's a very kinky girl, the kind you don't take home to mother. In this case, you know, I'm trying to introduce so many characters so quickly, and it's a good mechanism to have them be memorable and give them a little spin or a little viewpoint.
You don't know me. I'm not just one of your many toys. You don't know me. Don't say I can't go with other boys.
Thank you.
like Killer Croc is a Creedence song, Vietnam era song. And the lyrics make sense for him, and the attitude and sort of southern vibe of the song kind of work perfectly for him.
First, is it the music, the groove, or is it the lyrics? First and foremost, the thing that you want to attach to those characters?
Well, it's hard to hit in any specific sequence. Sometimes you take your visuals and you just spam music onto it. You just grab songs and you just keep trying and trying and trying. And usually what happens is you settle on something that works mildly, and then usually that song will then inspire the perfect choice.
Written for this film as well by artists. They were not put out to tender, so to speak, but you approached certain artists to collaborate together. How did that come about?
Well, we had a deal with Atlantic Records, and part of that deal was, you know, we would create some original songs for the movie. I started getting demos very early on, and a demo can be very rudimentary or it could sound almost like a finished song. And one demo I got very early on was, you know, the Kehlani Gangster track, and it became sort of the theme song of the Joker Harley relationship. And then Stephen Price did an orchestration with it and really turned it into something amazing in the context of the film. But it's this haunting, broken yet powerful, self-aware song that made perfect sense for Harley's journey.
Stephen Price, you mentioned, who you've worked with on, was Fury the first film that you guys?
Yes, yeah. Fury.
Tell us about that relationship and why that relationship started on Fury, and then how it's developed with working on Suicide Squad.
I mean, he's a brilliant composer and an orchestrator and does both traditional and non-traditional things. And in Fury, we did some pretty insane things with choral chants and mechanical noises and sampling. So in Suicide Squad, I wanted a traditional score because, you know, it's such a big movie. It felt like it needed a large traditional score, but at the same time, it's such an unusual film. It also needed its own attitude and voice. These themes very early on. You know, one of my favorites is the Enchantress theme with these buzzy, sort of angry string lines. You know, the Joker theme with, you know, this sort of tinkling, almost xylophone quality percussive element. And these themes help you as a storyteller, you know, remind the audience who's on screen, what's going on, and why they're there. It becomes part of their emotional cloak that they then wear throughout the film.
Loved within Fury, the score that Stephen worked on went against the expectations of that period. You had really metally orchestral riffs coming through.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you're making a movie for a modern audience, and if you hug the idea of the period music, it can often work against what you're trying to do because there's no history the audience is going to have to that music. So you need to connect the audience to the film, and the best way to do that is to use everything in the arsenal musically.
With a film like Fury, do you look to certain artists of that time, or do you not get into that space with it?
I mean, when I was working on it, it was interesting because for the Tiger Battle, I'd actually thought of dubstep because it's so dissonant and powerful. So it came from kind of all sources together. Listen to some Russian composers, Russian modern composers.
Can you reference any of the specific composers?
I'm probably going to mutilate the pronunciation, but Shostakovich.
How did you come across him?
I don't know. I have an insane music library, everything from Carmina Burana, opera, you know, the Ring Cycle. I need a broad understanding of music so I can pretend I know what I'm talking about to my composers and musicians.
And do you discuss with Stephen the idea of the contemporary music that you want to use in the film so that, you know, he has his head around that side of things as well?
Yeah, he's pretty much updated in real time with what I'm thinking regarding music because you want to be in a similar key, you want rhythm pacing. You sort of have to understand how it plays as an operatic journey, and so there's sort of continuity, and so, you know, he's very careful about tracking how the cut in the music is evolving together.
I also wanted to talk about the wonderful music in End of Watch. David Sardi, there's a particular track called I Am the Police that I absolutely love on the score as well. How did the music work with that?
David is a producer and produces many acts, so he has a pop sense and a rhythm, but also, you know, very orchestral quality to his work too. I mean, with End of Watch, we had a very synthesizer-based score. And David is, you know, you go into his studio and it's full of these vintage synthesizers going back to, you know, the very beginning of the science and art of electronic music. And he'll chain up 12 of these things to get a certain kind of sound. And he really knows how to twist sound around.
And also, you know, there are other moments where there's music on the radio. It's obviously part of the actuality of the film.
It's interesting because the hardest thing to do is to make something on screen in a movie feel utterly natural and verite. Because everything's engineered. Everything is engineered. Everything is staged. So part of that is in sound design and how do you make music seem environmental and that it's something that's being actively listened to by your actors. Hello. Turn your head round.
Take off that frown. Sup, putos? Big bad Ricky from Curbside Gang Locals. You ready for this shit?
Open the door.
It's also really interesting within that because the scene in the car where they're singing the Carmen song, which was, I believe, a happy accident.
Yeah, exactly. It came on the radio and, you know, I was sitting in the back with a sound deck and with a video camera and we were driving to Vegas from Los Angeles and they started lip syncing to the song and I thought it was amazing and we were actually able to clear the song. So it's just this natural, great moment that you can't predict.
Hey, ladies.
Hey, ma.
What's up?
Let's slide.
All right.
All right. And we gon' get it on tonight. You smoke.
I smoke.
I drink.
Me too.
Well, good. Cause we gon' get hot tonight. Got drops.
Got clues.
Got trucks.
Got juice.
All right. And we gon' take a ride tonight. So, ma.
What's up?
Let's slide.
All right.
All right. And we gon' get it on tonight.
With Harsh Times as well, which I've read is the most loosely autobiographical piece of writing you've done, was the music in that very much reflective then of your experience and your life of that time?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely more of a snapshot of a place and time. So the music in that is immensely personal.
Is that harder to put in or do you just connect yourself more?
It was easy to put in because, you know, I am connected to it and I do enjoy it and it did have meaning for me. So it's such a specific moment and sense of place that film has. Very Los Angeles.
Let's start this party, all right? Kick out that fat, fat dance.
Feels almost like the music, the soundscape of your films musically almost is the closest we get to you. Would you say that's a fair assumption?
I think that's pretty fair, although I do like a lot of Pink Floyd, but I haven't been able to put any Pink Floyd in the movie yet.
What for you has been, as a film fan, what are the earliest things you remember musically being important?
It's, you know, the classic is obviously, you know, as a seven-year-old kid watching Star Wars. Score, you know, which obviously is iconic. You really saw the power of integrating imagery to music, and that's an example of the last thing you would have expected at that time to have been on a science fiction film. But I've grown up, you know, loving movies and loving film and loving music. You know, it's sort of the background track of my life.
Influence on David Ayer, that is, of course, the main theme tune from Star Wars, as composed by the great John Williams. My huge thanks to David for taking the time to talk to us. Now, you can hear last week's episode with High Rise director Ben Wheatley by heading to edithbowman.com, where you can also find a full track list for this show. We have a dedicated soundtracking Spotify account too, where I've curated a playlist featuring the tracks you've just heard in the order they appear. I'm Edith Bowman, and you've been listening to Soundtracking, a weekly celebration of music in film, out every Friday. For our next offering, I'll be joined by much-loved indie director Todd Solondz, the man behind Welcome to the Dollhouse and Happiness, whose latest film, Wiener Dog, is out now, and he is great value. So it'll be well worth joining us for that. I look forward to the pleasure of your company then.